morning, members. I'm going to call Human Services Finance and Policy to order. We have three large bills today on our agenda, and so we should get started. We do have to adjourn right at noon, so hopefully we can get through our agenda today. So the first thing I'm going to have, if Lindsay's not on, we'll have Ms. Vang take the roll call.
Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Representative Keel.
Keel, present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Sendell. And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Fang. Let's see, Chair Liebling, would you like to move the minutes from March 11th?
So moved.
Thank you. So Chair Liebling moves the minutes from March 11th. Any discussion or corrections? Okay, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the minutes from March 11th, 2021 are adopted. Let's see, members. The first item on our agenda, I know we ended yesterday with not hearing House File 1532. That's going to be the second item on our agenda. The first bill before us today is House File 1200. So I'm going to move that House File 1200 be re-referred to Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee. We have Representative Richardson with us today. Welcome to the committee. I know there's been a lot of work done on paid family leave, so I really want to thank you for your leadership on this bill. And I know Representative Halverson has worked on it in the past, but I know you've done a lot of work to get it, to get more support. It looks like it has bipartisan support now that it's picked up Senator Bach in the Senate. And I'm really grateful for you joining us today. I know this bill has been through many committees and it has more to go, but as a mother who did not take maternity leave, I'm really grateful and hope our state can join other developed countries in moving forward on this. So please present your bill. And I don't think you have amendments. I don't see any amendments.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Well, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves from illness. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans is it's not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% have access through an employer-provided temporary disability program. The lack of access demonstrates structural inequality. Those who are currently left out of paid family and medical leave programs are often those who need the access the most and are facing the most economic insecurity. Lower paid employees are disproportionately left out of paid family leave programs. Black, Indigenous, and other workers of color are also less likely to have access, and women are also facing disparities when it comes to access to paid family and medical leave programs. Most Minnesotan workers cannot afford to take time off without pay, without access to wage replacement, workers with serious health conditions put off treatment or return to work sooner than recommended, jeopardizing recovery and long-term health. The key to this bill is that would ensure that the vast majority of hardworking Minnesotans would not be placed in the impossible choice of choosing between caring for themselves, a loved one, or a paycheck. A serious illness or injury can devastate a family's economic security quickly, as many Minnesotans are only one, two, or a few paychecks away from financial disaster. In the midst of a global pandemic, it has become even more clear illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. The National Partnership for Women and Families has conducted national surveys on paid family and medical leave, and in the most recent survey, 8 in 10 voters and overall 84% of voters support permanent paid family and medical leave programs. A state-operated program has the potential to improve economic stability and health outcomes. From a human services perspective, there is research that pregnancy-related complications and recovery are the most prevalent type of medical leave claims for states with programs. Research on California found significant reductions in the share of low birth weight babies and preterm births as a result of its paid leave program. In fact, in California, low birth weight births decreased by 3.2% and preterm births decreased by 6.6%. Using March of Dimes data, a 6.6 decrease in preterm births in Minnesota could save over $19 million annually in excess healthcare costs associated with preterm births. There's also research on how paid leave impacts elder care. Family caregivers are one of the most important factors in allowing seniors to age in place. Research in California has found that paid leave programs reduce nursing home utilization rates by 11%. A similar drop in Medicaid-funded Minnesota nursing home placement costs could yield an estimated savings of $62 million to the state and the federal government. Women who have access to paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than women who take no leave. Working families with paid leave are more economically secure and are significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after their child's birth. Minnesotans want to work and they want to take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. We also have the added benefit to take advantage of lessons learned from other states that have implemented similar programs that have proven effective, beneficial, and sustainable, even in the midst of the pandemic. I have a few author testifiers with me today and would request, Madam Chair, that you recognize Ms. Deb Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. We have Deetra Fitzpatrick here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Chair Schultz, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I am the Policy Director for Children's Defense Fund. I would like to share a couple of quick slides, just ground us in the policies today that we're considering today. And I am also here today as the lead researcher on the state, the legislatively mandated study that was conducted in 2016 and updated in 2019. So just wanted to lay that groundwork that this policy is really grounded in the research and has been a long process of making sure we're getting this policy right in the state. So the policy that's before you today is structured as a contributory social insurance program, and that is the dominant and successful model in 8 U.S. states and most countries around the world. And what that means is that most employers and workers are contributing to a state fund based on wages. For the median worker earning around $52,000 a year, that works out to be about $3 per week for the worker and for the employer. Employers, there's a couple of exceptions in the bill. Employers with a comparable benefit program can provide their own program, and self-employed workers and contractors can choose to join the program. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and to earnings, so it's an earned benefit, plus the need for leave. Also important to note that healthcare providers in most cases are certifying the need for leave. and that workers are then making a claim on the state fund to have that support, financial support, while they're on leave. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes, both to reduce the burden on employers to make these programs aligned and also to help us ensure a successful build out. Why is this model, the social insurance model, the one that almost everyone uses? There are a number of reasons. I think one of the most important ones, given many changes in our economy, is that it's a portable benefit. That means it's not attached to a specific job. Again, as I mentioned, workers are receiving their financial support during their leave from this state fund. And this is really important when we think about the number of workers that have multiple employers or the number of workers that have at the same time or successively over a year. Also, COVID has taught us about how important it is to make sure that we have this safety net, sometimes not connected to employment. So it also creates the broadest possible risk pool, and that keeps the costs low for everyone. Those costs in the bill are split evenly between workers and employers, and importantly, that it levels the benefits playing field by geography and employer size, and also, I think, importantly, by employer need, the employee's need for leave. The way the system works now, if you're an employer and you have workers that a disproportionate number of workers that need leave, then you have to bear those costs on your own. This system kind of, again, spreads those risks and costs across the whole population. And finally, it's a durable and popular approach because everyone is contributing. It's an earned benefit and everyone has the potential to benefit. So with that, I'll stop and I'll be here for questions that folks might have as we dig into the specifics.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. The second testifier I have is Tony Manskow. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Oh, hi, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tony K. Manskow. I live in Rochester. I'm here today on behalf of AARP to tell you about my family and my experience as a family caregiver. Minnesota's population is aging and family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system. As a family caregiver, I am providing care to my mom who has cancer and my developmentally disabled brother who I became guardian for when my parents' health started to fail. My caregiving has included household tasks, grocery shopping, coordinating and attending medical appointments, filling out necessary paperwork, communicating with insurance providers, driving them to appointments, to more complex tasks like setting up medications and wound care. I have done all of this while working full-time. It's challenging and a full-time job, but my family needs me. Until a couple of years ago, my mom was living independently in an apartment setting. I believe she would have been able to remain in this setting for a longer period of time if I wasn't trying to balance my full-time job and caregiving needs all at the same time. She now resides in an assisted care living facility. We've had to exhaust all of her assets and her care is now paid through medical assistance. There were many tears shed when I knew my mom that had spent so many years raising me to be independent would now be losing her own independence. Working in cancer research, I hear from other caregivers with similar experiences. Through the years, my role as family caregiver has been a financial strain. During a 9-month period in 2017, I went without 1/3 of my yearly income due to unpaid time away from work. I have declared bankruptcy in the past. I wasn't able to afford unpaid time away from work, keep a roof over my family's head, buy groceries, pay utilities, and other necessary expenses along the way. In the past 2 months, my mom has been hospitalized twice, spent time in a skilled nursing facility, and most recently was told she needs to switch her cancer medication to a drug that will be administered monthly through an IV in an outpatient setting. She will need to have family with her. I'm not sure what the future may bring for my family. Regardless, like so many Minnesotans do every day, whether the time away from their jobs is paid or not paid, I will be away from work to provide the support my family needs. Having guaranteed paid time away from work to care for my family would ease so much stress related to my own finances. Each caregiver's story may be unique, but yet still are the same. We do anything for our loved ones. The value of a family's emotional support and presence during a loved one's illness cannot be measured, and it should not be degraded or punished by the fear of financial difficulty. As caregiving becomes the new normal, more and more Minnesotans will likely be caregivers during our lifetimes. No one should ever have to live with making a choice between not paying their bills and sacrificing their loved one's well-being. It's time for Minnesota lawmakers to pass a paid family and medical leave program. A growing army of Minnesota family caregivers are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mansko. Really appreciate your testimony. Thanks for sharing your story with us this morning.
Thank you.
The next testifier is Sarah Piepenberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, and then proceed.
Am I on? Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please proceed with your testimony. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Sarah Piepenberg, and I'm the co-owner of Vinaigrette, a family-owned food store located in Southwest Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Main Street Alliance of Minnesota. 2 years ago, one of our most valued long-term employees, Linda, fell and broke both of her arms. She was unable to work. A widow in her 60s with only a small pension from the telephone company, she'd taken a job in our store to make ends meet. If she wouldn't get her paycheck from us while she was out recovering, she was going to have to choose between putting food on the table and making rent. We couldn't accept that as employers. We decided to cover Linda's full pay while she was out, which ultimately totaled $2,000. I was happy we did it, but it greatly impacted our family. Having to cover these extra shifts and on top of trying to make sure Linda received her pay, our family was late on our home mortgage and commercial rent payments. I've looked into plans available on the private market, and the best option would cost 50% more than this proposal. It only offers 6 weeks off, excludes coverage for cancer, no paternity leave, and require a health screening. In other words, the private market provides unaffordable, substandard options. This shouldn't be a struggle for any of us. The bill creates a system where everyone pays in a little and everyone benefits. I support this policy, and the majority of small businesses agree. A recent survey of 600 small businesses found overwhelming support for public paid leave policies. There was a major support across party lines. Another survey also showed that, like me, the vast majority of small business owners, 84%, are not able to provide paid leave on their own, and said a social insurance program would help them offer paid leave to their employees, helping them attract and retain dedicated employees like Linda and avoiding the costs involved in replacing her. Small business owners and our employees alike need a paid leave program like this one in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Piepenberg. The next testifier we have is Corey Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Anderson, please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Corey Anderson, and I'm here representing NAFA, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, as well as MAHU, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. Madam Chair and members, I'm Corey Anderson, here representing those associations. We have more than 1,000 advisors in Minnesota. I'm the owner and founder of Disability Geek Insurance Agency, specializing in disability insurance. I've been in the business over 20 years. I have 4 employees through the years who have worked when we've worked with on over 1,250 plus clients, protecting their income in case something was to happen. My employees, we've got some part-time and some full-time. It's my 20th year serving on the state and local NAFA board in various roles, and my 3rd year on the Health Underwriters board working on legislative related issues. I'm a frequent featured speaker at industry related meetings and teaching continuing education classes on this specific topic. So why am I here? I, along with MAHU and NAFA, are opposed to House File 1200. The members of this committee need to ask that what the problem does this bill solve? I say that because as a specialist in this area, I can tell you that the private sector has affordable products available with very broad coverage for just about every group and individual. The market is competitive with many providers offering coverage for disability income, so the prices are very affordable. To the extent that witnesses have run into problems finding coverage, they may need to talk to another agent that has more expertise in these lines of business because the solutions are out there. What this bill does is put the state government in direct competition with the private sector, both insurance carriers and insurance agents. This is not an underserved market. As I said before, the competition is fierce and the coverage is easy to come by, with companies fighting for the market share by offering product innovations and lower prices. I have reviewed the side-by-side comparison provided to the committee by the advocates. I understand that comparing such products may be confusing to someone without training in this area, but the chart is comparing apples and oranges. Specifically, the authors of the chart are comparing the government-run product with individual market products, which tend to be more expensive. In addition, the pricing noted in the bill comes from a government agency that has no experience in pricing such a product, and to the best of my knowledge, has not been evaluated by an actuary as a filed insurance rates must get approved by the Commerce Department. Family medical leave products that help you pay so you can take care of a family member, have a child, or out due to sickness or injury already exist with well-defined language. I work in this space regularly, and I can tell you that coverage already exists and the premiums are pretty reasonable. I found coverage for my team at my insurance agency for sickness, childbirth, etc. The premium my business pays on behalf of the three covered employees with wages over $50,000 is $106 per month. I don't think a one-size-fits-all product from a government agency that has no experience offering such a product or accurately pricing such a product is needed in the market. My clients and the public are not interested in another unfunded mandate that creates an annual payroll tax exceeding $800 million on the businesses that are already struggling to stay afloat, and their employees will not appreciate the payroll tax coming out of their paychecks. This bill also creates more barriers to entry for Minnesotans interested in starting new businesses. Please vote no. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
So members, please contain your questions to Articles 2 and 3 of the bill. And we have with us Martha James from House Research to answer questions, and then DHS to answer questions on MFIP, if there's any questions on the MFIP program. Let me see if Representative Richardson wants to make any comments about the testimony before we go to questions. Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief so that we can get to member questions and discussions, but I think it's really important to highlight the fact that the majority of voters are asking for paid family medical leave programs. And I also think it's really important to highlight that within this country, there's been a legacy of leaving people out of safety net programs within the history of our Social Security program that left out 60% of Black people within the United States, because it carved out exceptions for domestics, it carved out exceptions for farmers. And fast forward to today, the majority of Minnesotans do not have access to paid family leave programs, and it disproportionately impacts our lowest income workers, BIPOC workers, and women as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you did mention there was someone here from MMB, is that correct?
We have Martha James here from House Research.
I have one question and then a comment. If I could ask of Ms. James, if she could just give a cursory review of the fiscal note as she sees it in front of her.
Madam Chair and members, this is Martha James from House Research. So I'm a legislative analyst, not a fiscal analyst. So I'm not quite sure if I can do that, but I will do my best. So Article 3 contains the appropriations for the bill. And there are appropriations primarily in 2022 for the costs for Department of Labor indeed. Relevant to this committee is paragraph D at line 68.3. There is $574,000 in fiscal year 2023 that's appropriated to human services, and that's appropriated from the fund, which is the fund that's created in this bill. That's where the premiums are going to go into, and that's where the benefits are going to be paid from. And so that there's money appropriated to the Department of Human Services for information technology systems. I'm not quite sure what that means. If I had to express an opinion, I would think that that's related to perhaps some of the impacts on the human services programs. This bill requires that benefits that are paid from the program are considered earned income, and then also has some different impacts on employment service requirements. So that's kind of the human services impacts. And then, like I said, there's other appropriations to other agencies listed in that article.
Thank you, Ms. James. Excellent job. But now we have Doug Berg with us. So Doug, or Mr. Berg, would you like to add anything to that?
Madam Chair, that is, Ms. James got it essentially correct. The costs at DHS are for systems modifications in order to incorporate the effect on work and income into economic support programs that look at those things. I will note that there is a pending fiscal note on this bill that hasn't been completed on, I think, the current version, and I am aware that the DHS number will change somewhat. I do not know how much.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Berg, and thank you, Ms. James, for that. As Chair, you referenced this initiative was introduced in the last biennium by Representative Halverson, and so it has seen a good amount of due diligence. And I would just remind, if we need to, that this initiative would require a new IT system to be built from the ground up entirely from scratch. It would also probably, in all likelihood, add 350 new FTEs to manage the program. It would absolutely touch every employer in the state, not to exclude anyone. That would include then all small businesses, nonprofits, as well as government employers. It just significantly is an expansion on the obligations for also for hiring and keeping, maintaining part-time and temporary employers. Madam Chair, this is a major tax increase on every employer in the state, which includes all types of employers, whether they be nonprofits, cities, or school districts. And you can see the opposition that has been written about in years past. And in saying that, if we've learned one thing as a state, whether it be from MNSHR or MNLAR's rollouts, it is this: do not rush into a big IT project. This bill commits the state to a program that not only raises taxes to the tune of $1 billion, but it also requires a brand new IT system that will be built from scratch under a short timeline that the very department that will be administering it says they can't do. This bill goes too far. It really is an unnecessary and takes an unnecessary combative position against Minnesota employers. And rather than strike a cooperative, reasonable position on this, as has been said in testimony, the overreach is breathtaking. It's truly unfortunate, and I don't think it bodes well for compromise. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Well, we need to make investments. There's a huge benefit for this bill, and I would say if all humans could give birth and if all humans had to be caregivers, we wouldn't need this bill. But you know, this is a big deal for people of Minnesota, and that's why we're hearing the bill. And there has been a lot of work on this bill, and luckily we have an IT expert couple with us. Let's go to the first question on my list. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question actually really builds off your comments just now, Madam Chair, because when I think about this, I think about the overwhelming evidence, and not just you know, concrete and scientific evidence, but just in our gut. Like, we know that when you have a brand new baby, and I feel like I hear this from our colleagues across the aisle, we want parents to be with their children. That's the most important thing. And to expect a parent to be back at work sometimes within a day or two of giving birth, much less a couple of weeks, et cetera, we just know that that makes absolutely no sense. And there's massive societal benefits. So I guess my question, maybe this is to Ms. Fitzpatrick. I mean, there would be great justification to simply have this paid for out of the general fund when you think about the societal benefits. You've chosen not to do that. This is a really much more, just a different approach that you've taken. And I'm just curious, given the amazing benefits to this, why we wouldn't simply be having an allocation of funds by taxpayers to make sure that we have this, knowing what incredible benefits there are. We pay for our public education. We pay for a lot of things that have massive benefits. This, in fact, has more benefits than just about anything we could identify. So what's the thinking in set up this kind of a structure?
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Ms. Fitzpatrick?
Hi, Chair Schultz, Representative Pinto, thank you for the question. I guess, as I said earlier, there's a lot of reasons this is the you know, kind of dominant model. And I think it really does come back to this idea that it's an insurance approach. It's the idea that we're all paying in a little bit so that when our time comes to need this program, and as we've said, pretty much everyone in the state at some point in their life would need such a benefit, that is there then for you. And I just think there's a lot to be said about that way of people feeling like they're contributing, that then, you know, again, when it's your turn, it's there for you. So I think there's a lot to the durability, stability, popularity of that particular model, you know, for those reasons.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick follow-up, reflecting as you're saying that, Ms. Fitzpatrick, then, that I mean, we and knowing how incredibly important those first days and weeks are, you know, we may or may not all be parents. We've all been babies. We all interact with throughout our lives and throughout our days with other people for whom it's a great benefit to us to have everybody else get off to that really good start in those first days and weeks and being with their parents. So I really respect what is incredibly modest and reasonable approach you've taken here. Thank you to you and to the testifiers. And thank you so much, Representative Richardson. This is such an important bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson. And, you know, first, I think that a little bit of what Representative Pinto had said is true, that I think we all understand and appreciate the real need to have parents be able to bond with their babies, to be able to formulate those relationships and that attachment in those early days, weeks, and months. And certainly that's a valid thing. And I think most folks would see the real value in that. So putting a small amount aside to be able to allow that to happen, I think just makes good sense. And it's a very practical way to approach it. So thank you for that, Representative Richardson, and for thinking that through. The other piece is regarding the IT, and all due respect to Representative Albright, I know that what he said is true, that initially when this was discussed, that there was some concern over the issue with the fact that we would have to be creating something from scratch. But I think that actually the conversations around existing systems and how we might be able to leverage some of those have been pretty extensive since that point. And I do believe that there are actually several options that have been reviewed that may be viable to help build a base or a foundation for that system. So we wouldn't necessarily need to do that from scratch. So just wanted to clarify that we've come a long way with regards to reviewing what the IT systems might look like.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the testifiers mentioned that this was the dominant model, and I last session looked into this extensively, and it was not the dominant model. And so perhaps new things have happened, but I would love to hear about that, because my understanding is that most of the other states have a model where it's an employee tax, not an employer-based tax, and also that most other states have a carve-out for small businesses. This is an incredible burden on small businesses, and so I would just like to understand if things have changed substantially in the last 2 years, because this was not the dominant model 2 years ago. Thank you.
Ms. Fitzpatrick?
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Robinson. I guess when I was speaking to the dominant model, I was talking about the social insurance idea, the idea that we're paying in. I think it's a complex thing when you look at other state programs. There are a variety of ways that employers and employees pay in. There's a variety of ways that small businesses are handled within these various programs. Most of them don't cut small employers out. In fact, that's a key benefit of this model, is that small businesses are able to benefit and provide the same levels of support then to their workers that large Fortune 500 companies currently provide, because they are able to, and they do it because it makes business sense for them. So, you know, I think it is complex. I just want to be clear that the dominant model was just that social insurance idea that people are paying into a state fund and receiving their benefits from the program. These are the states that have passed a program, not the ones that don't have one, and looking at the rest of the world. So,
thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Representative Robbins, and then Representative Noor, and then we will go to a vote. Representative Robbins.
Thank you for that answer. Yes, and I'll continue to research it, but my understanding is most states that do mandate it, it's primarily an employee-based tax, not an employer-based tax. So I think that's something we could look at as an alternative. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quite frankly, this is a great program, and I just wanted to thank Chair Richardson for bringing this bill forward and continuing the conversation. This is just for less than a cup of coffee a week. We can provide a paid family and medical leave for a covered employee who has a serious health condition or is caring for a child, as a new child, as you've heard from other members, or a family member with a serious health condition. Members, this is a common sense process. There are provisions in this bill that allows employers to opt out if they can provide a better program or equal to what we are offering in this bill. It is critical that we provide a sense of protection. We have seen other states who have implemented this program, and the state has been involved in learning from what they have seen from other states. And quite frankly, our state system for unemployment is one of the best systems compared to many states. You have seen how they're struggling. We have learned a lot. This is not the same programs we have in human services, their, you know, 30-year-old system or whatnot. We're thinking about a new system, because we've learned IT has changed very much in the last 20 years. So this is a moment for us to step up. And I think to ensure those who are also recipients of a public assistance programs, that they can still continue to get additional income and allow them to do a better work. So thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that information, Representative Noor. Representative Richardson, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just really quickly, I did want to clarify a couple of things. One, I did want to build upon what Vice Chair Bonner talked about. We're talking about building on existing infrastructure within our unemployment insurance program. As Chair Noor has said, with the COVID pandemic, We were one of the first states in the nation to be able to respond with pandemic unemployment insurance to get up and running in order to support Minnesotan families. So I think it's important to identify that. And then also to Representative Robbins' question, just want to also highlight the fact that the way that the bill is drafted, employers have the option to share the cost with employees as well. So that is an option that currently exists within the bill as well. And finally, I just wanted to say, you know, Minnesotan families are continuously being put in a position of where they're having to choose between caring for themselves, caring for a child or a loved one, and a paycheck. And this bill is entirely necessary. I've heard the word unnecessary used a couple of times today, but the families who are finding themselves in that position should not have to find themselves within that position. And we know from the data from the Department of Labor that 25% of individuals who give birth go back to work within 2 weeks. And that is not how we set a healthy foundation for the littlest Minnesotans. So thank you for the opportunity to present today, and I ask for support.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, for presenting the bill. And thank you to the testifiers for your testimony. Okay, with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion to refer House File 1200 to the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee. As recommended, this requires a roll call vote. Ms. Hansen, can you take the roll? Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
Burkle, no. Representative, Fisher is excused. Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Moore.
Aye.
Moore, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Novotny, no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, nay.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Sandel, excused. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Thank you all. Chair Schultz, that's 11 ayes. Oh, I'm sorry, 1 second. Seven nays, two excused, and nine ayes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. And the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Richardson. On to your next committee stop. Okay, members, the next item on our agenda, we're going to go back to House File 1532. Remember that we had adopted the division report in the last meeting yesterday from Behavioral Health. So I'm going to lay over House File 1532 to be included in our Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Frederick, I see that you have an A4 amendment. Would you like to move your A4 amendment?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Can you briefly describe your A4 amendment?
Can I turn it over to Ms. Grom from DHS and Ms. Knutson from the Department of Public Safety?
You know, it might be better just to adopt it. I think it's a lot of technical corrections, and then they can speak to the bill as amended. So, members, let's take a vote on that A4 amendment. So I move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I know the author would like it before we make a presentation. So all those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Okay, aye.
The motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Frederick, do you want to make any introductory comments before we turn it over to DHS?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1532 is DHS's Community Supports Policy Bill. It includes provisions from lots of different areas of the administration, including behavioral health, disability services, and housing. The provisions in the bill have been vetted through stakeholders, and the department did incorporate that feedback that they received into these provisions. Some of these provisions include changes to the Children's Mental Health Screening Grants, the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council, Housing Stabilization Services, Community First Services and Support, Public Guardianship, and Behavioral Health and Disability Service Technical Updates. So at this point, I would turn it over to the department.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. We have Christy Grom with us. I believe she's going to walk us through this policy bill. Ms. Grom, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom. I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm the Legislative Director for the Community Supports Administration. So I'll provide a brief overview of each of the main provisions in the bill that Representative Frederick mentioned, just to make sure members have some context. I'd also point you to the bill index that's in your it's in your virtual packets or posted online that I hope will be helpful as you navigate the bill. It does look a bit large, but you'll see from the bill index that the bulk of the bill is really from two specific provisions that should be somewhat familiar to members of this committee. They're related to Community First Services and Supports and Public Guardianship. So first of all, I will start with Section 1, the Children's Mental Health Screening Grant. So this proposal modifies the way data is collected for children's mental health screening grants. Briefly, I'd note it doesn't change the data classification. The data will remain private data, and we've had conversations about that in Judiciary and Civil Law Committee earlier this week. The Children's Mental Health Screening Grants were established in 2003. They facilitate early identification of mental health conditions for children in the child welfare and juvenile justice system. They are administered to nearly all of our Minnesota counties, as well as three tribal nations. And we believe they're a really important tool to help us ensure that children get the right services at the right time in their development. We know there's a critical window within when services need to get commenced in order to get the optimal treatment outcomes. Specifically, this proposal modifies current law to allow county boards and tribal nations to provide the commissioner with individualized data for the purposes of program evaluation and improvement. So under current law, we're able to get minimal amounts of basic summary data, but not really enough to understand how the grants are impacting children and where there might be gaps in outcomes and why. MACSA has been supportive of this proposal, and they've shared their support along the way as this bill has moved throughout the various committee stops. The next proposal I can touch on is our State Advisory Council on Mental Health. So this is Section 2 of the bill. The State Advisory Council makes recommendations to the governor and to the legislature, as well as state departments, on improving our mental health policies and practices. This is really a membership cleanup proposal, so the council has reviewed this and approved it, and in some cases asked for some of these changes. The first membership update removes the Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network of Minnesota membership seat. This is no longer an active organization, so we're just replacing it with a generic kind of term for a consumer-run mental health advocacy group. The next change is there's a seat added from representation from the American Indian Mental Health Advisory Council. We just want to make sure that we're having adequate representation from our American Indian community on the council. We're adding a member from the Minnesota Department of Health, which was a request from the department. And then we're just clarifying some of the terminology related to the DHS appointee. It incorrectly references an assistant commissioner of mental health. And so we're changing that to the assistant commissioner who oversees behavioral health policy, just to reflect current titles. Section 3. Deals with our day service needs determination. So this proposal updates our current needs determination process for day training and habilitation, also known as DTNH. Since DTNH is no longer, we're going through some service changes right now as a result of some of our day support reform. So DTNH is no longer really a service. At the end of this year, everyone will instead be on day support services. So this is really just cleanup around that kind of terminology change. So a bit of background on the needs determination process. We have authority under current law to conduct needs determination process for DTNH and other day services. That authority is also underscored in our federally approved HCBS transition plan with CMS. That's the plan that sort of assures that we have the appropriate oversight over services that are provided in settings that could have the potential of isolation or isolating people from the broader community. So the needs determination process does not limit the services a person can receive. Instead, it would potentially change the types of settings that are available in a particular region. So as part of this process, we want to ensure that services are available throughout the state rather than concentrated in specific areas. We have worked with providers on this proposal, and we believe that they are okay with us moving forward with this, and we will continue to work with them to make sure that this is a process that works for all of us, not just DHS. So specifically, that proposal repeals a section of law that refers to the DP&H needs determination and just clarifies terminology in the existing authority to align with current statute. The next proposal I will talk about takes up the bulk, I would say, of this proposal. It's related to public guardianship modernization. So it's in sections 4 through 47, and there's some associated repealers as well. So this proposal modernizes the public guardianship area of law. It's consistent with the modernization updates that happened in private guardianship in the 2020 legislative session. So public guardianship is a last resort option where the Commissioner of Human Services may be petitioned to provide guardianship when there isn't another option. For a person who has a developmental disability and may have a questionable capacity to meet their health and safety needs on their own. So this proposal primarily consists of terminology updates that align with person-centered practices and person-first language. For example, we're changing the term ward to instead be person subject to guardianship throughout the bill. So you'll see a lot of those changes. In addition to the terminology changes, there are three a little bit more substantive changes that I can briefly touch on to provide some context for members. Those are repealing the public conservatorship provision. So public conservatorship is no longer used largely. I think there were some reforms in the early 2000s, and it was just determined that it would create a potential conflict of interest to have the same entity providing guardianship as the entity that provides those kind of financial management duties that go along with conservatorship. So you'll see throughout the bill several instances of that being removed. Private conservatorship remains an option for people and is considered one of the quote unquote less restrictive alternatives to public guardianship. You'll also see a lot of references to less restrictive alternatives throughout the bill. And this bill, like the 2020 modernization, requires that less restrictive interventions are ruled out prior to pursuing guardianship to ensure that there's no other options for people. We want to make sure that this is really a last resort option. Some of the examples of less restrictive alternatives could be using a power of attorney or a rep payee. Another example is supported decision-making process. So supported decision-making is also referenced throughout the bill, and this is really an alternative to public guardianship. It's a person-centered approach that acknowledges that people, including elders, people with disabilities, myself, some of yourselves at some point in our life need occasional help making decisions. So even though someone might not be able to make decisions completely independently, they may still be able to participate in that decision making, and there is a lot of value to that. Next, I will move to the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council provision. So these are in sections 49 and 50. There are four parts to these changes, and the council has unanimously voted to approve all of them. The first part staggers membership terms to allow half of the members appointed to expire on September 30th, 2022, and the other half to expire on September 30th, 2023. The next provision allows grantees to use up to 10% of the grant award for administration of the grants that the council awards. Current law allows 3%. So we want to make sure that there's enough administrative expenses so that they can actually, grantees can do a proper grant evaluation. The next part of this proposal is really a lot of clarifications around roles. So just ensuring that we're talking about, you know, what the council makes recommendations to DHS, and DHS is actually the entity that would manage the procurement process in alignment with our procurement state laws in Chapter 16. And then the last part of this proposal modifies a timeline for reporting grants proposed to be awarded. So this is a legislative report that we currently are required to do in March, and this would change the legislative report to December. So, and it's related to just making sure that when we do the legislative report, we actually have access to the information we need that's required as part of that report. So it's just a timing issue. The next provisions in this bill are related to community first services and supports implementation. These are in sections 59 through 83. So this proposal should look somewhat familiar. We've had it before, before the legislature. I think the last time was in 2019. CFSS, Community First Services and Supports, will begin to be implemented this fall, I believe. And this is the service that will replace personal care assistance and consumer support grant, and really expand people's choices about how they receive their services, who can provide those services. For example, parents of minors and spouses can provide services under CFSS, and there'll be more self-directed options for people. I'd say this is one of the most critical proposals in our policy package this year, since implementation is right around the corner, and many of the changes are really to ensure that people have the appropriate protections in place when they're receiving these vital services. So I'd also note that the CFSS Implementation Council has played a pretty critical role in developing and refining this language. The provisions include a variety of updates. Notably, there's some clarifications around the definition of activities of daily living that's kind of lifted from the current PCA statute and put into the new CFS statute. There are protections for people's rights related to service termination and reassessment, and there's also requirements that workers have the necessary training and competency to carry out tracheostomy cares and other really critical tasks. The next proposal I'll touch on is our housing stabilization updates. So these are in sections 51 through 56. Housing stabilization services are a newer state plan Medicaid benefit that help people with disabilities and older adults find and keep housing. They really help people transition to housing in the community and make sure that people have long-term stability. So this proposal is pretty simple. It corrects terminology related to those services. Right now, current law refers to housing stabilization as housing support services, and that's the incorrect name. I think it was maybe a remnant of some old federal definition. So we're just changing this to the correct name and statute. And then we're also adding the requirement for annual vulnerable adult training and the home and community-based documentation standards, which are both current practices for other home and community-based service providers. And then the last provision is really a lot of technical updates, so I can touch on them very briefly. We're updating the name of Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to Behavioral Health Fund to align with the new name. We are making an update in the Youth Act area of law. So last session, some changes were made there, and a requirement for an individual treatment plan was inadvertently removed. So we're just reinserting that. There's an updated cross-reference, and then there's a change related to our HCBS transportation provider standards, which is just a technical fix clarifying that provider standards are reflected in our federal waiver plans. When the HCBS documentation standards were passed, there was an incorrect cross-reference to NEMT standards, which are different than our waiver plan standards. So that, in a nutshell, is our community supports policy bill. I am happy to stand for questions from members. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. So do that so quickly. Very good. Okay, members, any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick, do you know whether or not Representative Hollins has had a hearing on 1649 in public safety?
Representative Frederick, do you happen to know that?
I don't typically track some of the other bills like that, so I'm unaware at this time.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, your A4 amendment is a composite of House File 1649, so I would expect that you would understand that probably predisposes this bill for a hearing in public safety. So I'm wondering if your intention is to take it to public safety as well.
Representative Frederick, do you like DHS to respond?
Someone here from Department Public Safety to be able to address some of those questions.
Yeah, I think we have Kate Weeks here. Ms. Weeks?
Good morning. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs. And here I can speak on behalf of that. Yes, Representative Holland's bill did receive a hearing in the House Public Safety Committee. I believe it was last week. Chair Mariani is carrying a large Department of Public Safety omnibus bill. And this is a provision in that bill that was approved by that committee.
Thank you, Ms. Weeks. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick, in the notes, as well as in your bill, there is a provision that raises the administrative cost from 3% to 10%. I'm just wondering why a 7% increase is necessary when, in looking over the notes from the September 18th meeting of the council, it notes that they were expecting $20 million and have only received $13 million at a time when less revenue is coming in. You're asserting that you need more money in order to adjudicate the process of grant requests. How is that sensible or responsible in light of the lost or lack of revenue?
Representative Frederick, I think I'll direct that to Ms. Graham unless you want to respond. Ms. Graham or Representative Frederick?
I would just say that, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So there are those provisions that are in the amendment, and I was asked if that could be attached. So thank you for bringing this up, because this isn't something that we had talked about yet, so I appreciate the opportunity. But yes, I would refer to the department at this time.
Ms. Graham or Ms. Weeks?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. So the provision in the bill that relates to the ORAC Council and the increase in administrative funding is actually about the amount of funding that a grantee can use for administrative expenses. So when the council gives a grant to an organization, right now that organization can use 3% of the grant for administrative expenses, and this would change it to 10% to align with industry standards. And we do really want to make sure what we've heard is that grantees are feeling like they don't have the necessary funds available to actually do a robust evaluation of that grant that they get, and we want to allow for that to occur.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Baker and I spent an inordinate amount of time on this provision, so that's the purpose for my line of questioning. I also note the provisions in your amendment also redirect funds currently allocated to MMB towards the council for flexibility in making those valuations. How does that square with the answer that was just provided?
Representative Frederick or Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, could you point me to the line in the bill that you're referring to? I'm not familiar with what you're referencing.
Ms. Graham, I don't have a reference point in the bill, but I'm looking at the notes from the September 18th council meeting where they depict Representative Cagle suggesting a transfer of the funds allocated to MMB to the council for flexibility in making program evaluation decisions.
Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I can get back to you with more context on that. That's not a part of this legislation, as far as I'm aware. This is a policy bill that doesn't really touch on those financial aspects.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick, in the body of the policy bill, you also note that there have been changes to NEMT standards that are more nuanced DWRS transportation standards. That are in line with legislative intent. It sounds good, but could you elaborate in terms of what that really means?
Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. So in 2019, the legislature passed HCBS documentation standards that applied to waiver providers that required them to maintain documentation of services that they provide as a condition of getting payment. So it was a program integrity measure. In the language that was passed, there was an incorrect reference that would subject home and community-based service providers to non-emergency medical transportation standards, which in some cases, I believe those NEMT standards do apply, but it's not for all HCBS providers. Those standards are different because these are different services. So HCBS transportation standards are enumerated in the federally approved HCBS waiver plans. And without sort of aligning this statute with current policy, we could risk loss of service access for people because some of those NEMT standards are actually a much higher bar and really are not needed for certain types of waiver transportation. So we want to make sure that providers understand what the expectations are of them, that they're in the waiver plans, not NEMT specific, and that people have access to those services.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Thank you for the questions, Representative Albright. One more question, and then we need to move on to the next bill. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frederick, even though the NEMT Council was decommissioned a year ago, I'm wondering if you've spoken with and reached out to the stakeholders of NEMT in terms of their weighing in on those provisions that we just discussed.
Representative Frederick.
I know that there was lots of stakeholder conversations across all provisions of the bill, and feedback that was received during those conversations were incorporated into the language.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Not seeing any other questions. Representative Frederick, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say that it's a good bill. A lot of technical changes and focus to be person-centered throughout the bill, and I would appreciate all the support. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Frederick. So House File 1532 will be laid over. The last item we have for consideration is House File 1151. House File 1151 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. We have with us Representative Agbaje. Welcome to the committee. Your bill is now before us. Please introduce yourself for members and describe your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. So today I'm presenting House File 1151, which is also titled the African American Family Preservation Act. The purpose of this bill is to keep Black families in Minnesota intact when they come in contact with Child Protective Services. These families find themselves at the mercy of a court system they know little about, and at a structural disadvantage because caseworkers may not be knowledgeable of cultural considerations when deciding on where an African-American child is best placed. This bill is meant to address those disparities that Black families face in the child protection system. The disparities show up in reporting, where African-American children are over 3 times more likely than their white counterparts to be reported to child protection. When this happens, caseworkers assess these homes and often institute removal proceedings when there are not egregious allegations of harm, but instead families need supportive services, whether that's better housing, education opportunities, employment, or healthcare. In those situations, African-American children are removed from their home at least 3 times or even higher than their white counterparts. And we see that 60% of cases involving African-American children are assigned to the family investigation path for discretionary reasons compared to 39% for white children. This family investigation path has proven to be more punitive, involves the courts, and places maltreatment findings on African-American parents, often when it's not warranted. So in order to provide some protections when facing the intricacies of the county and court systems, this bill seeks to require that counties engage the African-American family network of a child, point towards helpful services or resources for the family, adds a right to counsel for emergency removal hearings, specifies that a court cannot terminate an African-American parent's rights solely because of a failure to complete a case plan, and provide the ability for an oversight council to promote an advanced policy meant to support African-American children and their families. We all know that healthy families are vital to the success of our children and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring Minnesota's child protective system is fair and equitable. Your support of this bill will help decrease racial disparities and the injustices faced by those families. I have a number of testifiers here with me today, so I will turn it over to them.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje, and thank you for your work on this bill. And I know Chair Moran has done a lot of work in prior sessions, so I want to recognize the work she's done too. So we'll go to the testifiers, and then we'll open it up to member questions. So the first testifier I have is Andre Dukes. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the community. My name is Andre Dukes, and I'm here representing the Family Refuge Village Council. And we are concerned with the negative and disparate impact of child protection interventions on African-American children and families in Minnesota. We are also concerned that little has been done to reduce the number of children in the system in decades. The Family Refuge Village Council is comprised of Shiloh Temple International Ministries, Minnesota Association of Black Social Workers, Wellspring Second Chance Center, child welfare professionals, educators, mental health providers, and others. As representatives of the African-American faith and professional communities, we are aware of the deficiencies in the current child protection system. We believe that we can do better for our community, better for our families, better for our children, and better for our future. The dollars currently invested in the broken child protection system should be redirected and invested in the children and families impacted by poverty and most in need of supports. We believe that there is an urgent need to pass the Minnesota African American Family Preservation Act and create a framework for operationalizing an infrastructure that moves us beyond perpetual child welfare service provision. The present system lays the groundwork for subsequent generations of African-American children to be traumatized and wounded in the name of protection. We want more for our community, and we believe that the Minnesota African-American Family Preservation Act will establish a framework of transformative partnerships between the state of Minnesota and African-American communities. The priority focus will be on the health and well-being of our children and families, and we will work in collaboration with the developers of this legislation and others to support the passing and operationalization of this bill. I am also here with the co-chair of our council, Lynn Lewis, if you have questions for us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dukes, for being with us today and your testimony. The next testifier I have is Latasha Bacon. Please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome, and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Latasha Bacon, and I'm a parent mentor with Minnesota One Stop for Communities. I'm a parent who's gone through this myself, and in March of 2018, I sent my kids to my ex and his family for daycare so I could work. After 2 days, they returned the kids as usual, but there was something wrong with my daughter, Layla, so I decided to take her to Children's Hospital, only to discover that her leg was broken. I was then informed we couldn't leave and that child protection was coming. 12 hours later, child protection shows up and explained that the kids had just returned from their dad's house, that they were gone all weekend, and then I explained exactly what happened, but they removed my daughter that day, and 5 days later, they took my son, saying that even though they didn't know where she received this injury, I am the custodial guardian, so by law, I'm responsible. So our first court date was a permanency petition. I have no criminal record. I've never been in trouble of any kind with no previous contact with child protection. My kids were placed in multiple foster homes where they were abused. I continuously reported the abuse and was ignored. They returned my son, but not my infant daughter, pending a mental health evaluation. But unfortunately, on August 26th of 2018, my 18-month-old daughter, Layla Jackson, was murdered by her foster parent, 30-year-old Jason Betlech, a Caucasian man who killed her merely because of the color of her skin. My son, who was 8 at the time, reported the abuse and even tried to protect her from the beatings by taking his little sister and running off into the woods to hide. As a result, he was kicked out of the home and she was murdered shortly after. To add insult to injury, a video of Jason screaming white pride at Layla was found in his phone when he was arrested, but still, this isn't being considered a hate crime. Jason's wife, Jessica Betlech, ignored the abuse, even going as far as talking to her family about how she hoped she wouldn't lose her child because he was being abusive to the foster children. Even with the thought of losing her own child, Ms. Betlech did nothing to report the abuse even after, and wasn't charged with the crime even after Layla's death. Layla was born at 24 weeks. She weighed 1 pound, 8 ounces, and she fought very hard for her life, spending nearly half of her life in the hospital just to be cheated out of it too soon. On September 7th, the day of Layla's funeral. My mental health eval came back with no ongoing mental health issues. Needless to say, if there was provisions in place like the African American Family Preservation Act, maybe my daughter would still be alive today. Those who are responsible should be held accountable regardless of why they were in foster care. She didn't deserve this. They said that she was in the safest place for her, and now she is dead. They took two kids from me, and I only received a half of a shell. My son is broken and has mental health issues. They aren't making trauma-informed decisions, and they aren't doing what's best for our children. Thank you.
Ms. Bacon, thank you so much for your testimony. My sincere condolences. I'm so sorry you had to live through so much tragedy. And I hope we can get things, improve things so this doesn't happen to more families. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is Jody Wentland from Hennepin County. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of committee. I'm Jody Wentland. I'm the Assistant County Administrator for Hennepin County, and I am here representing Hennepin County in support of House File 1151. In Hennepin County, we recognize it is our responsibility to change the course of the inequities that exist in the child protection system, and therefore support the goals of the proposed African American Family Preservation Act. We began a pilot project that works toward the shared goals of the African American Family Preservation Act, which aligns with the Hennepin County Board direction and organizational strategies in three key areas. Number one, child well-being transformation. Hennepin County continues to transform our services and supports for children and families that proactively supports child well-being. Disparity reduction. Hennepin County's disparity reduction strategy focuses on improving outcomes for residents of color in education, employment, income, health, housing, justice, and transportation. And third, racism as a public health crisis. The Hennepin County Board Resolution 20-0242 declared racism as a public health crisis. This resolution directs the county to advocate for policies to improve health outcomes for communities of color, support initiatives to dismantle systemic racism, and seek partnerships with local groups with track records of confronting racism. Hennepin County has made significant investments and improvements in our child protection system. Our board investments increased by 75% from $85 million in 2015 to $149 million in 2019. To support our child well-being transformation. Our system transformation goals included being transparent, accountable, and data-informed, reducing the number of families requiring a child protection response, increasing the quality of families' experiences when involved with child protection, and reducing the inequitable representation of families of color in the child protection system. We're starting to see promising changes. The number of children served in shelter placement decreased 50.8% from 2016 through August of 2020. And children in family foster care settings are spending more days with relatives. Statewide in 2020, children spent 62.2% of days in placement with relatives. In Hennepin County, that number was 67.2%. We've also seen a steady decline in the number of children entering out-of-home placements. This number decreased 45%. From 2017 through 2020. However, these promising changes are not enough. We know that across Minnesota, there is inequitable representation and disparate outcomes persist for African American children in child protection systems. African American children are more likely to experience out-of-home placement with 5.5 times more removals from the home compared to white children, and 4.9 times more likely than white children to have a parent with parental rights terminated. This disparity comes at a significant cost to African American children and families. The African American Family Preservation Act aims to protect and support the best interest of children and promote stability of African American families. Hennepin County's commitment of child well-being transformation, disparity reduction, and declaration that racism is a public health crisis positions us in full support of the African American Family Preservation Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Wendland. Our next testifier is Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Yes.
Yes, we can hear you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Ramsey County Commissioner and Board Chair Tony Carter, and I'm proud to be here today to offer Ramsey County support of HF 1151, a bill that makes significant efforts to keep African-American children safe and with their families. We can all observe and agree to the racial disparities that exist at critical decision points throughout the entire protection process, especially for African-American children and their families. At Ramsey County, we're committed to working with our community to address these disparities and to create a more equitable child protection system that works for all families. In our county, we are focusing on transforming our own systems and our procedures to help address these disparities and to find ways to ensure that more children are able to stay with their families safely, included among the changes that we are making in Ramsey County are the following: working to ensure that we are 24/7 available to respond with law enforcement and to be immediately available in all situations. A focus on early interventions and connections to children's mental health services. Working with our community and public health to create safety in family and kinship relationships. And safely diverting children in child protection cases to youth intervention and also to parent support outreach programs, which utilize specialized caseload multidisciplinary teams. This bill sets higher standards on child protection agencies to work closely with parents to find the family members or other kin who can take children in before turning them over to non-family foster care. Keeping children with family is important. And there are clear standards for child protection agency employees. Ramsey County agrees with the expectation that our staff will do their work honorably and that there should be consequences if not. We also look forward to the opportunity to working with the African American Child Welfare Oversight Council, which is created by the bill and with the Department of Human Services to improve the overall child welfare system. So we strongly support the African American Family Preservation Act, and we urge committee members to do the same. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, and thank you to our commissioners for sharing information the counties are working on to address these inequities. The last testifier I have is Kellis Houston. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Kellis Houston, and I won't be testifying. I'm here to kind of help answer questions related to the language of the bill, but I'm the executive director of Village Arms and the primary advocate of the African American Family Preservation Act. I like to add context when we discuss child protection. The vast majority of families that are involved in child protection are not involved for abuse against their children, whether physical or sexual. The vast majority are involved for issues related to poverty, and they're categorized as neglect cases. But of the 15,000 children we had in care, only 9% were there for physical abuse and 2% for sexual abuse. So that gives us some flexibility to offer alternative interventions for these families.
Thank you, Ms. Houston, for that information. Very, very useful. Okay, members, we have probably time for one question. A member has a question. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Agab Jay, thank you for bringing this before the committee. I reference this question based upon your background as an attorney. But I note in a number of the provisions in this bill that you are creating different standards for certain children and families. And I'm wondering whether or not you would weigh in on whether regarding the constitutionality of your bill in reference to those differences between family groups.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. Yes, that's definitely, that question has been posed in the past, but you know, we look at this and also when you look at various, clauses within the Constitution, you know, there are racial disparities within our system in Minnesota. And so this bill proposes to address those, to close those disparities, because we know that Black communities, communities of color, they're oftentimes at a disadvantage that's already in the system. And so it is upon us as legislators to really take that to see how can we reduce that harm and how can we close those disparities. So the purpose of this bill is to do that in a way that alerts counties, Child Protective Services, DHS, to these cases and ensure that African American children and families are actually being treated fairly. And so that way it doesn't disadvantage them compared to other families. So as we heard earlier, Hennepin County and Ramsey County are both dedicated to this work and have already actually started implementing some of this in their counties to make sure that African American children are protected and their families are protected. And in fact, it really goes back to kind of the rights that people have in terms of their liberty to be able to live freely in this country. And I think that this is an area that we can continue to promote that by ensuring that we're keeping these families.
Thank you, Representative Aglaje. I'm not seeing any, Chair Liebling, I'm not sure if you want to make a comment because.
Well, if there's a moment, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I just wanted to thank Representative Aglaje. I know that she, this is a big bill and a really super important bill. And as we, you know, as we are so much more aware and trying to be more aware of structural racism, this is a bill that really brings that into our awareness and how we damage kids from the very beginning when they don't have to be damaged, when we can do so much better for them. So I know this is a tough bill to carry and a big issue, and Representative Moran carried it before, and I just want to appreciate her for doing that. And also, especially, I know that we have great difficulty pronouncing her name, so I wanted to ask her to pronounce her name again for all of us, and if there's a way to help us remember it, you must have something you tell people to help them remember how to pronounce it.
Representative Aglaje?
Yeah, it's a melodious word, you know, and so if you just listen carefully, you can get it, but it's Aglaje.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Aglaje, I'll get it right. Okay, we are running out of time, members. I know this is a very important topic, and I really appreciate Representative Aglaje's work and the work of Chair Moran and all of our testifiers today, and the work Ramsey and Hennepin County, what their work they're doing. So we appreciate you coming to our committee today. And this discussion is not over. There's a lot of work to do, and we as legislators are all very eager to resolve and address these issues. So thank you, Representative Aglaje. If you want a closing comment, sorry for the limited time, but go ahead, Representative Aglaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just ask that members of the committee, really look closely at this. We're in a year of racial reckoning, which I think we are always in that year, but we have an opportunity to do something about it. And I think this is a way that we can. And I encourage all of you to continue to ask questions as you have them. Would love to have your support as this continues to move forward. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Aglaje. So with that, members, I'm gonna lay over House File 1151. And we will be meeting next week. Everyone enjoy your weekend. Thank you for meeting on a Friday. I will see everyone on Tuesday. And with that, we are adjourned.